This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you live from Tonga's capital Nuku'alofa. On the program today, fears a possible US travel ban on three Pacific countries is playing right into China's hands.
China actually, by comparison, is making it very, very easy for Tongans, for example, to travel to China.
Also, a measles vaccination drive wraps up in Vanuatu, and authorities crack down on the exportation of exotic animals in the Solomon Islands.
With the transit closed, it's a big problem. Not just for me, but for all the trappers out in the provinces who work with us.
All that and more coming up. I'm Marianne Kupu. Let's get started. Cook Islands Prime Minister Mark Brown will front Parliament today about New Zealand's decision to pause millions of dollars in budget assistance. It's the result of a diplomatic spat caused when Brown signed agreements with Beijing without consulting New Zealand. As Finau Fonua reports, there's questions now about how the government will fill the budgetary hole.
Relations between New Zealand and its former colony, Cook Islands, are at its lowest ever. A statement from New Zealand's foreign ministry says development funding has been paused because trust had been breached over an agreement Rarotonga signed with Beijing earlier this year. All eyes were on Cook Islands Prime Minister Mark Brown when Parliament convened yesterday.
It's not halted. It's paused.
Facing questions on the floor of Parliament, Cook Islands Prime Minister Mark Brown referenced his New Zealand counterpart Christopher Luxon's state visit to China.
I have full trust, Mr. Speaker, that Prime Minister Luxon has entered into agreements with China that will pose no security threats to the people of the Cook Islands, despite, of course, not being privy to or not being consulted on any agreements that New Zealand may enter into with China.
But for the opposition MPs, it's no laughing matter. Opposition leader Tina Brown says news that the Cook Islands' largest foreign donor, New Zealand, is pausing foreign assistance is a major concern.
I really am disappointed. I'm disappointed for our people because of the decision that this government made, and you know, without being transparent to the people at the time, back in October last year.
Brown agrees it's a harsh measure by New Zealand, but it isn't unfair.
Yes, I think so. As a Cook Island. However, I do understand the reasons why they can't keep feeding us, and then we're running away and straying.
Cook Island News has been closely covering the diplomatic spat since it began earlier this year. Its editor Rush Neil Kumar said the timing of the pause comes just as a budget reveal commenced in the Cook Islands Parliament on Monday.
In the 20-odd page review report, the Public Accounts Committee briefly mentioned that they were concerned that there has been a reduction of core sector support and some of $10 million due to a level of uncertainty and ongoing discussions with the New Zealand government.
Mr. Kumar says the pause would have a significant effect.
New Zealand funding is quite substantial. The support that has been paused for this upcoming budget is somewhere around 4%, I think, of the total budget, but still it supports core public sector services and ministries, including health, education, tourism, and others. So yeah, it's not much when you compare it into the bigger scale of the overall budget, but still it's quite a substantial amount.
Opposition leader Tina Brown says she and other MPs have tabled questions which Prime Minister Brown will respond in Parliament today.
The ABC's Finau Fonua with that story. Meanwhile, New Zealand's Foreign Minister Winston Peters says he's spoken to his Chinese counterpart about the nature of his country's relationship with the Cook Islands. Fronting the media since aid to Cook Islands was suspended, Mr. Peters says the Cook Islands government failed to provide satisfactory answers to questions about the China agreement.
Well, the decision was made slowly, because we were asking a series of questions in writing and not getting satisfactory answers. That is, satisfactory answers that would be able to for us to account to the New Zealand taxpayer, and also, more importantly, to the Cook Islands people, the diaspora, both there and across the world, in Australia and New Zealand in particular. So we've got responsibilities ourselves here, and we want to make sure that we didn't put a step wrong in our commitment and our special arrangements, which goes back decades.
New Zealand Foreign Minister Winston Peters speaking to the media.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots, dub, sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Coreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
My name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music.
Saturdays, 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
A senior Pacific researcher is warning China may take advantage of a proposal by the US to impose travel bans on three Pacific countries and further grow its influence in the region. Dr. Malakai Golamatangi from Tonga National University says Tonga, Vanuatu and Tuvalu are not a threat to US security, despite being named among 36 countries for travel restrictions.
You wouldn't equate the Pacific and the peaceful Pacific to other trouble, with other trouble parts of the world. And certainly, the US has always been an additional friend of the Pacific. And yes, I was surprised. I think myself and others, not only in the Pacific, but also in the diaspora overseas, quite surprised to see that these pre-Pacific islands were included on the list.
Why do you think these Pacific nations, Tonga, Vanuatu and Tuvalu, are being targeted by the Trump administration?
It's a very good question. And I think, I see that the governments of Vanuatu and Tonga have asked the Trump administration for clarification and the reasons why these countries have been included under the travel ban. We can guess, I suppose, the U.S. State Department has issued some reasons. For example, because of terrorism, terrorist activities, or people overstaying their visas in the States. Some of these countries all three countries had sold, passport selling schemes in the past to generate revenue. The U.S. is saying that it's worried about countries who sell their citizenship. And although, of course, other countries do it as well, not only these three specific countries. They also give official reasons as to these countries are not cooperating with the security measures that the U.S. has put in place, and also they're not facilitating or not facilitating enough cooperation between the U.S. and these countries, which are quite interesting reasons. And, taking the face value, some of them could be are correct. There are a lot of, there are some people who overstay their visas in the U.S. and other foreign nationals also do the same. I'd be interested to see how many people from these Pacific islands actually overstay their visas. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. What are we talking about?
Is it clear what the next steps are? Because it's not set in stone that a ban on these additional countries will definitely occur. What do these countries have to prove to the US in order to not be subject to the ban?
Well, the 60 days have been given as the period duration in which these countries have to show, probably through systemic evidence, that they have complied with the wishes of the U.S. in terms of, the overstaying. They are also being accused of not helping the U.S. with the deportees, from the U.S. To these countries. So I'm guessing that the U.S. wants evidence that these countries are willing and have made changes to the system and their approaches, and that would give the, you know, to allay the fears that the U.S. obviously has with, you know, in these areas.
If the ban does go ahead, what would it mean to the Tongan community and diaspora?
Look, I think there's about around 78,000 Tongans that have called the U.S. Their home. There are a lot of Tongans who travel. Many Tongans travel or want to travel to the U.S. And of course, now they have to go through Fiji to get their visas, and some of course don't get the visas, so they come back after spending money, you know, in Fiji and so on and so forth. The I think it just makes things harder, obviously, make it more difficult. It is actually quite difficult now to get to the U.S. if you are a Tongan citizen. The ban will make it obviously almost impossible. We don't know what you know, family gatherings and that kind of thing. And you know, for example, a lot of many Tongans have visas to study in the U.S. You know, all those, for those reasons, it'll be quite sad, I think, if the ban does is imposed on Tongan and Tongans cannot visit the U.S. And also, of course, that'll not only the actual travel itself, but the implications that arise from the ban, I think, will be far-reaching. There's a history of U.S.-Tonga relations during peacetime and also during the wars, where Tonga has stood by the U.S. to fight in theaters, for example, that have nothing to do with Tonga, for example, in the Middle East and so on and so forth. Trade is, you know, is important. The geopolitics, as you know, is this area, this the Sub-Pacific, the Pacific itself is a growing important area in terms of geopolitics, with, you know, the one with China and so forth, taking a much interest in what's happening. Security itself, you know, if the U.S., if the relationship's sour and these countries do not accept the U.S. into their waters and so forth, it could become problematic. Actually, it will probably aggravate that very problem that Trump wants to see resolved. You know, I'm also thinking of the future relationship between the U.S. and Tonga. You know, there was a disengagement, for example, prior to Obama. And then, of course, there's been a kind of a re-engagement. But obviously, this will be a complete severing of the ties between Tonga and the U.S. So, you know, the consequences will be far-reaching. I have no doubt about that, if this ban goes ahead.
How damaging could this be for the U.S. and its desire to have more influence in the Pacific?
Well, I think if what the U.S. is wanting from the Pacific is to have more influence in terms of, you know, the geopolitics and economics and security and so forth, then it's going about it the wrong way. This will have the opposite, very opposite effect. It will drive the Pacific towards Asia and towards China, because, you know, China actually, by comparison, is making it very, very easy for Tongans, for example, to travel to China. So if I were wanting to, you know, to go, you know, not to go to the U.S., but have China as an option, I would jump the chance to go to China. I mean, it'd be easier. Friendly people, they're more accommodating. They've got an embassy here in Tonga, and they are, you know, becoming an important part of the social and economic life of this of the country. You know, the Chinese immigration and so on. So China will be the counterweight to the lessening of the U.S. influence in the Pacific.
That was Dr. Malakai Kolamatangi from Tonga National University speaking to the ABC's Yvonne Yong.
Pacific Beat.
Taitailele motolo to Pacific Beat. Let's still stay with Vanuatu, where history was made this week with the appointment of Angeline Glenda Dovoroi as Attorney General. She's the first woman ever to hold the position. In a moving swearing-in ceremony, Mrs. Roy acknowledged the spiritual, professional and personal support that brought her to this milestone. The CEO of Transparency International Vanuatu, Dr. Willie Tokon, told reporter Lia Lowombo he hopes this will bring change to the role of the Attorney General.
I have two comments. One is that big congratulations to her, and also it's a good step forward for all our young potential leaders who can step forward. So this is a very big step. She's the first female Attorney General, so it's a big step for women in our country. So a very big congratulations to her. But my second comment is that actually I was preparing a press release for this week. You know, our Attorney General, when the Public Service Commission terminates the contract of a civil servant, that the defense is done by our Attorney General's office. And so far, 99.9% of the cases, the civil servants have won. So I'm hoping that this young lady will step forward and give good advice, and the advice must be taken by ministers or politicians who want to make decisions that will affect people's lives. I know she's a strong woman, so we're looking forward to a new era in that area.
You mentioned she's a strong woman. Do you know her personally?
Yes, I know her through a family connection from Pentecost. I know that she comes from a very strong family. The mother is a very strong woman leader in the country. I think she works for the National Women Council, but not very close. She's from another island. Before this, she was also the chairman of the Anti-Corruption Commission in the Ministry of Justice. She works for the Attorney General's office, but she was also the chairman of the Anti-Corruption Commission. That's how we came to know her.
What challenges do you think she would have had to face or overcome to be able to be appointed and be at that high office as the new and first female Attorney General of Vanuatu?
She's been there for a long time. I think she's some 20 years. So everybody there should know her. They should respect her. She's a woman who carries herself well. She speaks well. Like I said, she was the I think she's still the chairman of the anti-corruption committee that the government has set up. Our women in leadership role, facing some of our men still don't give that respect to women. Sometimes they tend to bypass them to make decisions. I've seen a few in few DGs now who get pushed here and there. They are DG, but they don't know what the directors are doing because the minister comes and asks the directors to travel with them or to do other things, and the DG doesn't know anything about it. So that's why I said she's a strong lady, but she needs to keep that professionalism and that strength up so that she can do her work instead of being told what to do.
And you're hoping that there would be changes now with her appointment as the new Attorney General?
Yeah, I hope that she will now give good, strong and firm advice to the Prime Minister or the ministers or Public Service Commission. She should be able to do that, or the Attorney General is supposed to do that, because when decisions are made, terminating a director by a flying minute, and you just keep quiet, you, the advisor of the government, legal advisor of the government, you don't say anything, doesn't make sense to me. And then the case goes to court, the government loses. Then the government says, no, we'll engage a private lawyer. No. And I hope that she will be, you know, she will be respected, and she also needs to be firm. I'd like to see the day when Attorney General stands up and speaks up and says, listen, this is what we have advised, this is what you should do.
That's the CEO of Transparency International Vanuatu, Dr. Willie Tokon, speaking to Lia Lowombo.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Staying in Vanuatu, where the Minister of Health has wrapped up a measles vaccination drive covering nearly all of the country's provinces. The program was scheduled for last year but couldn't be completed because of a lack of funds. Vaccine Preventable Disease and Immunization Manager Seymour Sampson says more than 8,000 children were immunized.
We have discovered that our coverage for measles and rubella vaccine is under the expected for last year, as we are 64% missile coverage. And then we also have reports of outbreak in the Western Pacific region. So the immunization program within the Ministry of Health, Public Health, has come up to decide on a plan to make a catch-up for the dropouts and also the defaulters from our target group to cover the measles coverage. So then we come up with a catch-up. That catch-up was scheduled on the 19th of May to the 31st of May. It was the 2 weeks catch-up where we sent measles vaccines over to the provinces, and the provinces facilitate it to the health facilities, and the health facilities did the distributions of the vaccination. Our target group is 1 to 5 years to check whether kids from 1 to 5 years, if they have not received the first dose within the first year, 1 year, or second dose within 1 year, 18 months, then they will have the shot. This was done around the country, and we still have yet 2 provinces for them to cover and then send the coverage data over.
Australia has given funding towards this exercise. Why is that important?
The funds, since that we have scheduled the catch-up, we understand that PFHA have contributed to the provinces and they have helped the health services in the provinces. So we requested the funds for PFHA in the provinces to help the nurses to far to reach areas to reach the missing children. And we have used the fund, some of the province here to access the fund, but the funds are provided by the VFHA and also with the support of Vanuatu government. It is very important to uplift the immunity coverage of measles because the important thing is to try and protect and increase the country immunity so that if there's any breakout, then it might not cause many damage in the population. The funds are allocated for the province to carry on with certain health service deliveries. But since that we scheduled that catch-up, then we asked the VHB if it would reprogram this activity and then to sponsor the activity, like providing the transportations, especially transportations, and we use it to transport the nurses to further rich areas to their communities so that they can carry on with the vaccination for MMR. Not only MMR, even if they come across any vaccinated chance that the child is missing it, so they also give that vaccine to the child.
If the immunization program is not being done, what sort of implication will that have on children?
Well, if the catch-up has not been done, hopefully, this year we will not meeting our target, which is 90% coverage. So the catch-up has been helped in quarter one just to speed up children who are missed or receiving first and second dose of the MMR. This catch-up has helped a lot. And we really need to do the catch-up or outreaches within the second and third and fourth quarter to put Vanuatu's coverage in a stage where the immunity stage would be much stronger for any outbreak of the measles virus.
You say that the money that has been provided is targeting transport, but some of these nurses may not come from those places they are visiting. So what about accommodation costs?
Really, the accommodation, it doesn't need much the accommodation because the health facility was located within that area catchment. Only if it is too far where you go in the morning, you have to come back in the afternoon. But you are not crossing the ocean or you are the river bank or something like that, the big river where you need to stay out.
Has Vanuatu had any reports of children being affected by measles?
We have our last outbreaks of measles in 2015. But at this point in time, we were vaccinating the kid just to prevent any outbreak and also to maintain our nation immunity. The catch-up was done due to low coverage that we have last year for measles. And then also, there's an outbreak in Australia and New Zealand. We have tighter flights. So we did a catch-up to make sure that kids are well protected from the virus.
Seymour Sampson, Vaccine Preventable Diseases and Immunization Manager in Vanuatu, speaking there with Caroline Tiriman.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the era to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Senior journalists in the Pacific say several colleagues are facing jail for alleged defamation and they don't have the resources to defend themselves. The chair of the Pacific Freedom Forum, Robert Iroga, has previously said the region is facing a critical moment for press freedom. Journalist Leilani Reklai is the editor and publisher of Island Times in Palau and co-chair of the Pacific Freedom Forum. She's being sued for defamation over an article she published about a local company's tax affairs. She told Lucy Cooper that previously it was just governments who target journalists with legal actions, but now the corporate sector is joining in.
We are seeing many of the senior journalists in the region, including myself here in Palau, being sued for defamation, for reporting stories, especially with relating to corporations, financial agencies in the region, in some of the countries in the South Pacific. They're reporting on public financial institutions like banks. In my case, I reported a story on a tax policy that was implemented here in Palau, specifically leaked information that were on social media about a business, individual business taxes. So these are information, this is the type of what we're seeing across the region. This is not the first time, but we're seeing more of it. We're seeing especially senior journalists being targeted, and it's worrying to see this, because it seems to be strategically targeted at those who have the seniority that are being listened to in specific areas of our region. So it's sort of a message that's being sent out, is that we will use financial means to stop this information that we don't want to go out. Oftentimes we tend to target government. We would be targeted, for example, by government, governments around the region not wanting the media to report or force the government to be transparent. Now we're seeing this happening in the corporate space. And that is much more worrying, because many, if not almost all of the media in the Pacific region are small operations. They're either individual reporters or they are small newsrooms, and their greatest vulnerability is financials.
Is it a case of it's quite an easy target?
Absolutely. And I think, too, that given that now with such wide coverage of the media, with internet now, that stories are no longer restricted to, say, just specific countries. Now the world is seeing what's happening in the countries. That's more damaging to, let's say, a business or an agency that may not be transparent, or they would feel that they have more impact on their operations if stories about them go out.
You mentioned yourself, you're one such journalist facing a case of defamation, and I appreciate you can't go into it too much in terms of the legalities, but from a personal standpoint, what's been the financial and emotional toll that this defamation case being brought against you has had on you?
To be honest, I've been in denial stage, but I think you know, it's really getting to me. Financially, it's been quite, you know, stressful in a sense. My company is very small, It's really five, six people. That's everything from reporting to printing. And it's been stressful on my family, because it's not only financial. We are in a small community, and reputation is everything. So it has been taken its toll on not only myself, but our family as well. It's not something we expected. I think the story that I put out was very straightforward. It was really based on the press release that was released by the company itself. And so it was very much an unexpected situation. And now that I'm in the midst of it, it's really taken a huge financial toll on me, which of course translates to stress over this, but it comes with the territory, I guess. We just have to deal with it right now.
That's Palau journalist Leilani Reklai speaking with Lucy Cooper. Solomon Islands is the Pacific's largest legal exporter of wildlife for the exotic pet trade, a quiet but lucrative business that sees parrots, lizards and other animals trapped in the forest and sold into homes around the world. UN data suggests more than 1,000 live animals are exported from the country each year, feeding into a global trade worth over $40 billion, much of it unregulated or illegal. Authorities and private companies are starting to tighten controls, but those working in the industry fear the changes could devastate local livelihoods. Priyanka Srinivasan with this story.
On the outskirts of the capital city, Honiara, a row of metal cages is perched on the side of a hill. Inside, birds screech and shuffle. There are white cockatoos, their feathers dusted brown with dirt. Next to them, flashes of red and green, eclectus parrots. Next to them, pigeons. Hornbills too, massive black, white and yellow birds, over a foot tall, with curved red and white beaks. In front of all the cages, a wooden box. When the door slides open, I see snakes coiled up inside. These trapped animals are in limbo, awaiting shipment to private collectors and exotic pet dealers around the world.
All these birds here are going to Jordan and Malaysia.
Angelina Palmer, Angie, has run this wildlife export business for more than a decade. Every month, she and her team send off crates of Solomon Islands' unique birds and reptiles to buyers around the world. But lately, business has stopped. Fiji Airways, one of the only international airlines flying out of Solomon Islands, has recently suspended live animal shipments.
If transit closed, then we have a problem. Not
with the transit closed, it's a big problem. Not just for me, but for all the trappers out in the provinces who work with us. They rely on this too. We pay them for the animals that they catch, so it's a source of income for them. That's how they survive. And for us, this business is how we make a living.
Solomon Islands is the Pacific's largest exporter by species of wild-caught animals for the exotic pet trade. Parrots, lizards and hornbills are shipped by the hundreds to buyers in the Middle East, Asia and the United States. The trade is legal, and for many in the country, it's a lifeline.
That's the whole reason why this business is still ongoing.
Joseph Huritarau is the Director of Environment Conservation in Solomon Islands government.
For wildlife trade, it's not open to foreigners in terms of exporting them. So unlike, you know, forestry, logging or mining, where most of the foreigners are doing business, for wildlife trade, it's mostly locals who are doing the trade. So we believe that whatever money they've been receiving from the export, the locals are taking.
On Santa Isabel, one of the most biodiverse islands in the country, trappers catch parrots and lizards for exporters like Angie to sell in the capital.
It can take a full day to hunt a skink.
Brian Pitamana lives in the southeast of Isabel and traps animals whenever an order needs to be filled.
How we trap these things is they climb these sort of trees or those coconut trees or whatever they like to climb. So the full day, maybe 2 or 3 hours, you just sit and wait. Hide someplace here and just watch.
He points to the bushes.
And when they run down, we can trap them using a fishing line. Here, let me show you.
String fishing line.
Brian loops the fishing line around itself and carefully ties a knot. It becomes a noose, with the long end hanging down.
We tie this round a bamboo or any sort of long stick. That's how we make it. Then, if you see it coming down a tree, you just...
Brian pushes his finger through the loop, imitating the neck of a lizard. The fishing line goes taut, and the noose tightens around his finger. Once caught, he takes the animal to the local village buyer. It's around 300 Solomon dollars, about 60 Australian, for a lizard, and about a third of that for a bird. The business is informal. Trappers only catch a dozen or so animals in a given year, though some of the animals can die of strangulation if the men don't check on the traps soon enough. But the income is significant for communities with few other ways to earn a living.
It's good. We can get a bit of money from this, just for a small bit of work.
Accurate data on Solomon Islands' exotic pet trade is hard to access, but according to the UN, more than 1,000 live animals are shipped out of the specific nation each year. Now that industry is under growing scrutiny. Authorities and private companies, like Fiji Airways, are beginning to pass reforms amid concerns over animal rights, wildlife trafficking, and biodiversity loss.
So already numbers are low. And the numbers going offshore are not, you know, small numbers, they're large numbers.
Dr. Patrick Pikachar is an environmental scientist from the Solomon Islands.
So essentially, there's an impact in terms of habitat loss, which is the main driver of species extirpations and extinctions in Solomons. And you couple that with collection, it's double the impact. And so if the trade continues unregulated as it is, it could impact the populations of some species, mainly the parrots and maybe some lizards as well, especially the monkey-tail skink.
The government has tried to impose restrictions on the trade. It recently banned the sale of the lucrative monkey-tailed skink and certain butterfly species after a 2023 UN notice raised concerns. But enforcing these regulations is difficult. It's an open secret in the country that loggers sometimes trade food, electronics and alcohol for animals. This sort of trade is illegal, but hard to detect, so often goes unpunished, says Rory Barco, the head of environment for Isabel Province.
There are people doing a trade with regards to the wildlife here. I'm not really sure of what's happening with this logging places, because we are not close to go and monitor when they have the shipment. So we can't know really what's the quantity they do, what they're hiding, what they're sending. I've seen people go and trade with the white parrot, cockatoo, and they trade for this musical, like tape recorder or something. So I've seen that, and I know those practices are still ongoing, but most of those who came and trade, because those ships, they were Asians. So they are the ones that came and exchanged for maybe even alcohol.
So that would be unregulated, right? Illegal shipments?
Yeah, so those really are unregulated, but our challenge now is we don't know when actually the shipments are happening. We don't have really the support in terms of to travel to those places in just the actual time. We are understaffed.
On the other end of the chain are the collectors of wild animals, the majority of whom are based in the United States, the world's largest market for exotic pets. Samson Michael has been collecting reptiles for most of his life and has an entire room in his Tennessee home dedicated to them.
These are another species from the Solomon Islands. These are emerald tree skinks.
After seeing a monkey-tailed skink at a reptile expo, Samson developed a particular interest in Solomon Islands reptiles.
They just look like little green aliens. I mean, just cute as can be. A head that shape that kind of reminds you of Spike from Land Before Time. I mean, just absolutely alien and prehistoric looking.
He now has 11 animals from the country and takes great care learning about their behaviours and natural habitats so he can mimic the same environment in his home. Nevertheless, he grapples with the ethics of the trade.
I always feel bad seeing these animals getting taken out of the wild, even participating in it. I still feel bad knowing that they're getting taken out of their habitat. And I always feel bad when I hear about the people that are going and catching these animals. They make very minuscule amount compared to what the animal sells for when it finally does hit the United States open market.
Back in Honiara, Angie watches YouTube videos of Eclectus parrots speaking English to their owners.
Sometimes it looks funny too, but
it can look a bit funny sometimes, but still, you're looking at something that comes from here, from our country, and then you see it in another place being looked after like that, it feels good. You feel proud, like, oh, that's one of our birds from the Solomons, and now it's living with these other people who are really taking care of it.
They'll take good care of it.
Behind her, a hornbill lets out a loud squawk from its cage. Angie still doesn't know when or if it will be set free.
That's Priyanka Srinivasan reporting. The documentary Wild Cargo Inside the Solomon Islands Exotic Pet Industry will broadcast at 10:30 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. The Vatican has announced Papua New Guinea's first saint will be canonized on October the 19th. Peter Tarod was a lead catechist killed by Japanese soldiers during the World War II occupation of Rabaul for defying a ban on religious teaching. Catholics in PNG and Solomon Islands are excited with the news that one of their own is being recognized for his faith and sacrifice. Around 12 bishops and as well as church groups are preparing to go to Rome for the canonization. But Rabaul's Archbishop Roker Statamai says some are finding it difficult making travel arrangements.
Now the next thing is the challenge of people to go there to actually take part in the official canonization. And we have a couple of challenges. First and foremost, I think the bishops are trying to indicate that a good number be going. So far, as of today, we already have up to 12 bishops who have indicated that they will be going. And for us, we also have to be mindful of our own priests and religious and the local people from the parishes. The challenge is to travel overseas, you need a passport. And in PNG, for you to have a passport, you first have to have your national identity. And that is not easy. People have been submitting their names for NID, and up till now, they're still waiting for it. And I don't know if anything is going to be possible in time for others who may want to go. So excitement around the definitive dates that are there, like the 19th of October. Now the excitement is, can we make it all to be in Rome and that the logistical challenges that we have? Otherwise, for us in the Archdiocese, we will be waiting also on the Cardinal Prefect of the Dicastery or the Department of the Canonization of Saints to indicate to us when they think they will be ready to come out to join us for the local celebrations, which can and may take place in the Archdiocese of Rabaul itself, either in our cathedral church or at their home parish in Rakunai.
October 19th is not too far away now, so I wonder what the church and the people are thinking about what to do on the 19th of October.
We are waiting for it, but in the meantime, we are just telling our people to prepare for, because of the 7th of July that is coming up, the normal feast day is going to be celebrated. And I think everybody is aware now that this 2025, 7th of July, when we celebrate the feast of Blessed Peter Tarod, will be the last official celebration as blessed, because already the pending to be called Saint Peter Tarod, that will be on the 19th. So this upcoming 7th of July will be special in the sense that we will be celebrating the feast day for Peter Torot as blessed for the last time.
The canonization of Blessed Peter Torot to be PNG's and Melanesia's first saint, I mean, what does this all mean for his followers?
On the whole, there is inspiration for all our people, especially for married life and the families, the ideals that he lived for. And as late Pope Francis was indicating, that he was really keen on canonizing Peter Torot simply for the fact that he is the saint we need for our day, in the sense that we have many challenges with family life and marriage relationships. And so Peter Torot, because of his steadfastness in upholding the one man, one woman commitment, which is a covenant of exchange of love and the stability of marriage and family that we need for the upbringing of children and the continuity of society. So this is the relevance that our lay people are really excited about and would like to see the celebration that will also affect their practical lives and especially the married couples.
Archbishop Roker Stutterme speaking there with Caroline Tiriman.
Want to catch up or listen again to your favourite ABC Radio Australia programs anytime, anywhere? From Pacific Beat to Stories from the Pacific, Nisian Footy to Culture Compass. You can listen to your top shows on your favourite podcast app on the go and for free. Just search for your favourite ABC Radio Australia program in your podcast app and press play. ABC Radio Australia, bringing you more ways to listen.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots, dub, sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Coreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
My name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music.
Saturdays, 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. We'll be back at the same time Monday. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time with Eki Tupou. My name is Marian Kupu, bringing you the Pacific Beat live from Nuku'alofa. Maloa pita mo mea mai ka mo mea ofatu.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favourite podcast app to listen.